Good morning, everybody, for the continuation of our March board meeting. We are going to discuss two topics today in a shortened agenda. First, we start with rate regulation and then management commentary. So let's first start with rate regulated activities. And I give the floor to Mariella.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Hans. Our last meeting with you took place in September last year. In that meeting, the board finalized the discussions of the main aspects of the accounting model for regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. And from there, we started drafting the exposure draft. In January 2020, we mentioned to the board that while drafting the exposure draft, we had identified areas of the model that needed to be developed further and that their drafting was taking longer than we had expected. The staff have noted that board discussions were not explicit about some aspects of total allowed compensation. In particular, the discussions were not explicit about whether regulatory returns or performance incentives included in the regulated rates in a period form part of total allowed compensation for the goods or services supplied by an entity in the same period or in a different period. We have prepared three board papers today. Agenda papers 9A through 9C provide a further analysis on this aspect of the model. This paper do not ask the board to make decisions. A summary of all the recommendations and all questions for the board are in agenda paper 9B. Umer will present first agenda papers 9A and 9B. These papers provide background about total allowed compensation and discuss regulatory returns on the regulatory capital base and regulatory returns on the construction work in progress base. After presenting each paper, Umer will pause and will ask the board if you do have any comments. Neil will then present agenda paper 9C. This paper discusses performance incentives. He will then also pause and ask the board members whether they do have any comments. And after that, he will then go through each of the staff recommendations and ask the board for and ask the board questions on each of the recommendations in agenda paper 90. So with that then, we can proceed then with agenda paper 9A, and that will be you, Umer.
Thank you, Mariella. Okay, moving on to agenda paper 9A. Paragraph 6 of the paper in items discussed with the board back in 2019. These paragraphs cover the concept of total allowed compensation and its function in the model, the components of total allowed compensation, and the period in which allowable expenses and some elements of target profit, such as margins on allowable expenses and regulatory interest, form part of total allowed compensation for goods or services supplied in that. However, earlier discussions with the board were less on other elements of target profit. Those are dealt in the paper from paragraph 18 onwards. We first tackle target profit and start by highlighting the model's general principle in paragraph 18, which is an entity shall reflect the compensation or service supplied in the period when...
Sorry, Umer. Yeah. I hear a lot of paper hustling and now everybody mute their microphones. Continue, Omer.
Okay. So as I was mentioning,
why don't you, try again.
Okay. So as I was mentioning, we highlight the model's general principle in paragraph 18, which is an entity shall reflect total allowed compensation for goods or services supplied in the period when those goods or services are supplied. In the case of target profit, it may not always be easy to establish a link between target profit and goods or services supplied in a particular period. Therefore, to operationalize the model's general principle in the case of target profit, the staff recommends the principle stated in paragraph 21. That is, target profit that a regulatory agreement entitles an entity to charge customers for a specified period forms part of total allowed compensation for goods or services supplied in that period. For the reasons given in paragraphs 19 to 20, and as set out in paragraph 24 of the paper, the staff recommend to apply the principle of target profit to regulatory returns so that regulatory returns on RCB, that a regulatory agreement entitles an entity to charge customers for a specified period, form part of total allowed compensation for goods or services supplied in that period. The paper includes two examples, starting in paragraph 25 and paragraph 30, that illustrate the application of the principle for regulatory returns. These examples illustrate that applying the principle would result in an entity's profit pattern mirroring the regulatory profit pattern. In paragraphs 27 and 31, we considered the outcome from applying the principle for regulatory returns to be appropriate, because it is aligned with the general principle of the model for reflecting compensation in the period when goods or services are supplied. We have, however, identified two circumstances in which we think there is a compelling reason to recommend a different pattern instead. Those relate to regulatory returns on construction work in progress base that we discuss in Agenda Paper 9B, and performance incentives that we will discuss in Agenda Paper 9C. With that, I can pause here and ask the board if it has any questions or comments on the staff analysis in this paper.
Okay, I open the floor. Yes, Jian Zhao.
Thank you. I agree with staff's proposal. Particularly, I feel that the clarification on the general principle of the model is very useful, because I think currently we say that an entity should reflect a total allowed compensation for goods and services, all services in the period those goods and services supplied. I think this is consistent with the supplementary approach we decided before, which is based on the goods and service supplied. So I think this clarification is very useful. And based on this general principle, I agree with recommendation 1, 2, 3, that particularly for starting from the target profit, of course, there are two issues behind whether the target profit should be the component of total allowed compensation. And secondly, when, how to decide the period those target profit should be included. I think just on the general principle clarified, I think first that component should be the part of the total allowed compensation, because this is consistent with the supplementary approach we decide. Secondly, I think it's very useful to clarify that the specified period an entity is entitled to charge customers should be consistent with the period the good and service supplied. So I think this is very consistent with the general principle and very useful. And with regard to the regulatory return and also the regular returns on RCB and the CWIP, it's also consistent with the general principle classified. It's not, particularly for which period those regulatory returns should be included in the total allowed compensation. I think it's very useful to apply that general principle to clarify those issues.
Okay, I saw Mary. Mary?
Sorry, just a minute with the mute. Umair, thank you for this paper, and I think the staff is right in terms of bringing this back for clarification about how the general approach applies in some circumstances. I have a first about the proposed principle that is on the bottom of page 8, and just a minor but I think important wording question about that. And I'm going to test it with an example, if I can. Let's say that the regulatory capital base at the beginning of 2018, let's say that an entity has a regulatory return allowed, and it's calculated as follows. The regulatory capital base at January 1st, 2018, multiplied by the specified rate, and it's allowed for the capital that's invested in 2018. However, the entity is not allowed to include that return earned for 2018 until its billings to customers in 2019. Now, the wording that you have set out at the bottom of page 8 says for a specified period. And if I take for, I would have understood that fact pattern as included, therefore included in target profit for 2018. But working through the examples that the staff has provided in this paper, I think you are saying it would be included in target profit for 2019, because that is the year in which the amounts become billable to the customer. And I'm setting aside volume variances for a minute. So I think in terms of expressing the staff's objective, the wording should change from entitles an entity to charge customers in a specified period. I think that also would work in terms of volume variance, although it may be worth clarifying that, because the entity with a volume variance would be entitled to charge in 2019. It's just if there are volume variances, they don't actually charge until a later date when they do a catch-up. So that's one point. That's the kind of wording clarity of the example point. A second thing is, to me, instead of this being an application of the general principle, I see it more as a, I'll call it an exception for the moment. I think you have thought of that as an operational simplification, because in my example with 2018 and 2019, it was pretty easy to say it's for the 2018 regulatory capital base and it's just deferred collection. I think my inference from the paper is that the staff thought in some instances it would be harder to associate the allowed return with a particular activity, so you want to simplify it in that way. But because in my example of 2018 and 2019, I think the model's general principle is set out at the top of page 8 would say that that's a 2018 item, you know, 2018 total target profit. And the staff's recommendation is to say make it 2019. So I think we would be better off if we go this way to characterize it as a simplification that may result in some deviation from the general principle in terms of keeping the clarity of the general principle. Okay, so that comment here. Thanks.
So in terms of your first comment, Mary, regarding the wording point, so we think that your point on replacing for with in would work better, but to capture the volume variance as well, we would need to ensure that the drafting in our exposure draft covers that point sufficiently clearly. And in terms of your second point on the recommendation as a whole, as you rightly pointed out, that we are proposing this to be an operational simplification. And we are concerned that if we are proposing on the lines that if an entity is entitled to charge this, then it would be typical of a regulator to include those amounts in the rates for the same period. But if it is very clear that there is a strong compelling reason that it relates to this period, we would struggle to understand as to why it is not included in the same period that the regulator entitles an entity to charge. And that is why we proposed an operational simplifications so that whenever it gets included in the regulated rates during the period, that is when it becomes part of total allowed compensation. And if for any reason such as, for example, the demand is lower than anticipated and an entity is not able to recover those amounts in that period, then that volume variance would give rise to a regulatory asset in that case.
Okay, anybody else? Yes, Françoise, and after that, Tom.
Thank you, and thank you to the team for bringing this set of papers. I'm seeing it's important bringing or clarifying the principle in there. And
It's very difficult to understand. I also hear a hiss on the background. Is everybody on mute? Okay, yeah, that helps. All right.
Thank you.
Yes.
Sorry. I was saying that I was clarifying a principle in this project. I understand where the stuff comes from with that principle. So, I would say in theory, I support the direction that we take. Basically, I regard this as mirroring what was done and previously explicit on the allowable expenses side, and we try to do the same. So identify possible timing differences on the income side. So I don't object having that in what we are subject for consultation. I would, however, be wary of two aspects. First of all, bringing another layer of complexity in this model that eventually is not needed to bring useful information to users, or at least the information they're seeking to have. So I would have a particular caution on that side. And I'm also wary when we rely too much, or our model rely heavily on how a particular agreement is written. Because, in some cases it may be explicit, in others it may be less explicit, and the circumstances may not be that different altogether. So I will support the direction, but provided that in our consultation we really seek the effects of that, even I was expecting we would do it all together, but we really outweigh the cost benefit of adding this supplementary improvement, I would say.
Okay, thank you, Françoise. Tom, and then
Chuck. I like everything the staff's done. I think we're in a better place. I would like to see the general principle in paragraph 18 made clearer and precise, however. I think the word period refers to two things, but appears only once. So fundamentally, you've got the period in which the goods and services are earned, and you've also got the period in which the goods and services are reflected in the statement of financial performance. And so I think the definition could just be a bit clearer. I think somebody coming at this cold would have difficulty with that definition as it currently exists. But I think we're on the right track. I just like the wording improved a bit.
Okay, Changwu.
Thank you. The paper is very nice, and I agree with the steps, direction, and recommendation. However, I would like to suggest to you provide some kind of a elaborate explanation to our stakeholders on the some subtle differences between the general principle of the model and the recommendation one on the principal target profit and the regular return on the RCB, etc. So it's a kind of a inevitable approach because of some practical difficulties. So this is a kind of a practically best approach we can take. So that's why even though that's a inevitable, but we need to provide some kind of a explanation further, as Mary and others suggested. This is a kind of a quite reasonable approach. That's why this is a well-written paper, well-analyzed paper. So I'd like to agree with the recommendation direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Changwu. Who else? Anne, yes?
Thanks. Thanks, staff, for these papers, and thanks for your work in making these principles explicit so we can see. I know with the first one in paragraph 18, that was we talked about last year, but here you're putting it down and making it clear and showing how the other principles relate back to that one and then the principle around the target profit. So I found that really helpful. So I thank you for that. I do support the recommendation that's going to flow out of this paper, and I support what you're doing. I think I'm very aware of what Francoise said about the complexity, and here we're trying to wrap up something and we're layering in some more things. But I am convinced by your arguments that this is actually necessary for us to do this to the model workable. So on the one hand, I would like things to be more simple, but I understand why you've brought this and why we need to make these decisions. And I do support what you've done. So it's mean, of course, that the exposition or the explanation of the model, what are the principles and where we've moved away from them, becomes crucial in your our consultation document. So that explanation really matters. And this framework of showing what the principles are and where we've moved away and then why is very important. And that's what you're building on in here. So I do support what you're presenting. I would just like to make some reference to the example, and it comes up first in Table 1, Example 1, that follows paragraph 25. And one thing that you may be able to explain better in the consultation document, but something that struck me here in this example, is you talk about the regulatory return here on the regulatory capital base, and the interest rate on the regulatory assets and liabilities is embedded in the regulatory return rate, or I think that's how it's working. So I just draw it to your attention that as you put out these examples and make use of them, if you could clarify that, because to me it wasn't abundantly clear what had happened to the interest rate on the regulatory asset and the regulatory liability. Thank you.
Anybody else? No? Then I think we can move on to the next paper. Is again Umer or?
Yeah. It's the paper 9G, which discusses regulatory returns on construction work in progress, CWIP base. This paper applies the analysis in Agenda Paper 9A to regulatory returns on CWIP base. Regulatory agreement can include such returns in the regulated rates during the construction period of an asset or during its operation period. When regulatory returns on CWIP base are included in regulated rates only during operation, the application of the principle for target profit will result in those returns forming part of total allowed compensation during the operating period. This outcome would be aligned with the model's general principle that aims to reflect total allowed compensation for goods or services supplied in a period. When regulatory returns on CWIP base are included in regulated rates during construction, that is when the asset is not in use, applying the principle for target profit would result in those regulatory returns forming part of total allowed compensation in the construction period. That outcome would not be aligned to the model's general principle because during the construction period, no goods or services are being supplied, the asset being constructed. Therefore, for the reasons highlighted in paragraph 13 of the paper, the staff recommend in paragraph 14 that regulatory returns on a CWIP base that are included in the regulated rates during the construction period should form part of total allowed compensation only during operating periods of the asset. That is, when goods or services are being supplied with the asset to which those regulatory returns relate, in other words, over its useful life. As highlighted in paragraph 15 of the paper, applying staff recommendation, a regulatory liability would arise when regulatory returns on CWIP base are included in regulated rates charged during the construction period. That regulatory liability would be fulfilled and thus be recognized over the operating periods of the asset. The appendix to the paper includes numerical examples to illustrate application of the staff's recommendation when regulatory returns on seabed base are included in regulated rates during the construction period. So that is in example one, and during the operating period of an asset, which is in example two. With that, I can open the floor for discussion and ask the board if it has any questions or comments on the staff analysis in this paper.
Tadeo. Tadeo.
Thank you, Hans. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Omer, the team, for preparing the paper. I have just one question, and I do support the team's recommendation. It's just in relation to the in the appendix on paragraph A15. The example assumes that the useful life of the asset is the same for IFRS and regulatory purpose.
Yeah.
Would our recommendation, the paper, on paragraph 14 be different if the useful life of the asset were different for IFRS and regulatory purpose?
So our recommendation for CWIP returns that are billed during construction is that it would be reversed or derecognized or fulfilled over the useful life of the asset. So if in case the useful life is different than the regulatory life, the paper at the moment does not analyze that piece, and we can explore that further as to whether that reversal period should be the IFRS useful life or should it be the regulatory useful life. We have included in the paper an example when the regulatory return is during the operating period. And clearly in that example, you can see that return is reflected during the regulatory useful life.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else? Oh, yes, please. Rika, please. You're on mute.
Yes, thank you, Hans. Yes, thank you very much for preparing the very good paper with a very good example that helps understanding of this model, applying the general model. I support the staff proposal recommendation, especially when I looking at the example one, especially paragraph A5 and A9. If the arrangement were an ordinary IFRS 15 revenue contract with a customer, the revenue would not be recognized for X1 year and deferred as a contract liability. But in the example, and this is a case about some companies who engage in scope of this model. So in that case, the revenue in this connection is recognized from the year X1. So that means that the substance of this transaction would not be properly reflecting without applying the model of the general principle as recommended in this paper. So I think this is a very critical model to apply this type of arrangement.
Mary, please go ahead. Mary, yes.
Thank you.
Yep.
Omer, two points on this. I think you pointed out in this paper that the overall general principle of the model is to recognize the compensation when the goods and services are supplied to the customer. And you're making the point in paper 9B that basically construction services can never be provided to the customer. So therefore, it is not a service that triggers recognition of return. And so that's has driven the approach you've taken with the recommendation in this paper. So one of 3 points. One is a question about whether you have identified any other kind of operational requirement that might be imposed on a rate-regulated entity that would not deliver potentially deliver service, because I am assuming that things like availability, capacity, resilience, etc., are things that we would consider to be services delivered in the period, and so not need the kind of special guide. You know, and really, the staff's proposal is to point out that construction services do not qualify as a good or service delivered to a customer, and that is why your recommendation is do not recognize the income until you put the asset in service. So is there anything else that you've identified? Second, I think it's going to be very important to answer the question that Tadeu raised about what if the IFRS useful life and the regulatory life vary. And third is a brief IT question. Could you make sure you lean into the mic when you're speaking? Because sometimes when you lean back, it cuts out. Thanks.
Okay, sure. Yeah, so in terms of your first comment as to whether we had identified anything else, so the general principle of the model is to reflect compensation in the period goods or services are supplied. In this specific case, the returns are clearly attached to an item of PP&E that is under construction. And what the regulator or regulatory agreement is trying to do is just trying to enable the entity to recover those amounts quicker. And there are different ways that we have found out the regulatory agreements use. So it could be either during construction, either during operation, or a combination of both. What we are trying to achieve is basically to align the recognition of compensation in the period when the goods or services are supplied with that specific asset. So as I said, in this specific case, because that particular asset to which those returns relate to is under construction, and clearly with that asset, no goods or services are being supplied, yet an entity is able to charge those amounts using the billings for other operating assets. So what we are trying to do is try to recognize that as a regulatory liability so that it's only recognized as income over the period that asset is actually used to supply goods or services to customers.
Right. But Umair, if I can jump in there, yeah. I think what you're trying to make is a distinction between construction services. Because I think some people might argue that completing construction on a timely basis is a service delivered to a customer in the period in which there is timely construction, because that, you know, goes to the long-term robustness of the infrastructure, et cetera. So I think we're making a distinction about one kind of service, which is construction, and saying that construction will not deliver any service to the customer, versus other things that I think we may think could deliver services to the customer, for example, capacity availability, even if the customer does not draw the full capacity. So I think we just have to think about whether there's anything that sits right next to construction services about which there may be a question.
I'd like to add something, if I may, now, or is that okay? So in connection with Mary's note.
That's on mute. Go ahead.
Thank you. So when we had to analyze returns on the construction work in progress BAPE, what we had a starting point already, which was the discussions that were had last year on when an entity received prepayment for constructing an asset. And in that instance, we have discussed the entity would have to recognize a regulatory liability and reverse that regulatory liability over the useful life of the asset. In this paper 9B, what we are dealing with is, do we have to treat the returns on that construction work in progress based in the same manner as the pre-funding on the construction works, or should we have to, or do we have to treat them differently? And we concluded that we are treating them in the same way.
I think I saw Jen Chow and Daryl. Jen Chow?
Yes, just following Mary's comments, I think at this moment, clarification on the service is very important now. Previously, I always think that the goods and the service supplied or delivered is that those service and the goods after the constructed assets in place, and those goods and service, you know, delivered to the customer, and also the entity can charge the customer with you know, a judgment to the rate and this kind of thing. So from my understanding, this is we start with so-called supplementary, you know, model based on, you know, IFRS 15. But I don't think that service includes on a construction service. But Mary mentioned that maybe that construction service provide and charge. So I think this is very important to clarify further whether, from my point, based on the supplemental model, that service is narrow scope. That service is that exactly after the construction assets in place, and then that service delivered to the customer, and then the entity can charge the rate to the customer, and not based on the construction service. I'm not sure whether my understanding is correct.
Does the staff want to respond, or?
Oh, yes, Chengwu, yeah. So your understanding is correct. So we are not treating the construction service as a goods or service in the model.
Okay.
And
okay.
We'll be considering the fact that we explain in the exposure draft a bit what we refer to as goods or services. Yeah.
Daryl and then Rika.
So I guess what I'd be saying is putting together a little bit of what Mary said and what Jen Chow has just said, because I think both of those were important for me. And Mary, for me, this goes back a little bit to the discussion we had around the last paper and your point about the idea of thinking about this principle versus exception. And I agreed very much with the view that you expressed at that point. So when I think about this particular problem, for me, and this now picks up on Jen Chow's point, I don't think construction can be a goods and service that's delivered to the customer. At the same time, I think that there are some other things that are in this gray area where one might argue they are goods and services or might not. Now, my understanding of what the staff are trying to do here is to say that in the circumstance where I'm dealing with construction, it's very clear cut. I'm not doing something for the customer. In other circumstances, when I think about standby, resilience, those types of things, it's a lot less clear cut. And so it falls within that idea that we make an assumption about those because we think it would be very challenging for entities to establish whether or not they are delivering a service to the customer or not. With the construction, it's clear. The plant and equipment is not ready to provide that service yet. It will be ready to provide it at some point in the future. And when it does, clearly then it becomes part of the goods and services. So certainly that's the way I thought about this question.
Rika? Or yes? Rika?
Yes. Thank you. I'm on mute, so yeah. Thank you for this discussion. And I thought when staff is going to prepare the consultation document, if you use this type of the example, I think it's really critical to define or explain about the content of the performance obligation under IFRS 15 in terms of the contract with the customer. So I think if that is a very clear, the stakeholder all understand what is the arrangement between the entity and the customer, and no need to consider about why a construction service are not a performance obligation or not. So I think that will be very helpful. Thank you.
Any other questions Yes, Sue.
Just touching on this point that a few people have been raising about the line that's being drawn with construction. What I think is important and was part of my understanding of this paper is, I think, as a general proposition, sort of saying whether or not things are linked to construction or not could get difficult in some cases because, for example, sometimes repairs and maintenance might include an element of construction. But I think what works quite well in 9B, at least as far as I understand it, is that we're looking at a form of construction which will ultimately change what the sort of base is on which the return is calculated. So it's a link in with that change in the base, which I think is important as well. So it's not just a question of construction or not. Is that correct understanding?
Okay, so what the examples that we have in the paper, what they're illustrating is there is a base which is construction work in progress base. And normally what happens is there is a pool of assets or a regulatory capital base, which includes that construction work in progress base. And there is a return on that entire pool of infrastructure. And clearly what happens once that is ready and is placed in service, it continues to remain in the same pool. And so it would attract that return as it was attracting earlier. The only difference is the fact that earlier there were no goods or services being supplied with that asset because it was in operation. And once it's placed in service, it will be supplying goods or services. So I'm not sure whether I answer your question.
I think, yeah.
Okay. Are we ready to move on to the next paper? Yes, please.
Okay. I'll take it from there then.
All right.
Agenda paper 9C.
Correct, yes.
Okay, this paper discusses when performance incentives form part of total compensation. This paper distinguishes between non-construction and construction-related performance incentives and recommends the same approach for both. That is, amounts relating to a performance incentive form part of total allowed compensation for goods or services supplied in the period in which the relevant performance criteria are monitored and evaluated. That is, when the performance occurs. This principle is set out in paragraph 12 of the paper. The staff think that such a principle for performance incentives is aligned to the model's general principle, and that in addition, having the same approach for both types of performance incentives identified makes the requirements less complex. This is expected to result in more useful and understandable information for users and lower implementation costs for preparers. If a performance incentive is associated with construction activities, however, but is partly or entirely conditional on the entity's future supply of goods or services, then a portion or all of that incentive should form part of the total allowed compensation the entity becomes entitled to for the supply of those goods or services. And I'll just pause there and ask if the board has any comments on the analysis in this paper.
Jin Chao.
I'm thinking that based on the general principle we just discussed, that is the total allowed compensation should be based on, you know, the good and the service supplied. So I'm wondering whether this recommendation is really consistent with that general principle. First, because at that construction period, the good or service has not yet delivered, has not yet supplied to this customer. Secondly, even the construction activities carried out by the entity meets the performance criteria. But I'm wondering that even at that stage, the entity really can or really have full rights to receive that bonus incentive without including that performance incentives in the regulated rates, without providing a good and service after the constructed asset has been placed in use. So I think I'm struggling with, there's some inconsistency there.
Okay, thanks. So on the second point that you mentioned, this is what we cover in paragraph 19 of the paper, where we indicate that if there was some conditions attached to the incentive that required the entity to continue operating the asset or to continue operating the asset at a specified capacity or to a certain level, then the entity may conclude that a portion of the total allowed compensation, so a portion of the amount of the incentive, relates to the ongoing operation of that asset that was being constructed, and would allocate a portion of the total allowed compensation, therefore, to the operating period. However, we don't want to be overly prescriptive on this requirement, and we want to make it principles based on the facts and circumstances of the regulatory agreement. And so it will be a matter of judgment for an entity to conclude whether it has earned the bonus by conducting construction activities, or whether, as you mentioned, there are some conditions associated with the bonus that necessitate the operation of the asset as well, in which case it would look to apportion some of the total compensation to the operating period. Does that answer your question?
I think currently we try to, you know, draw a bright line, those, you know, construction related performance incentive, once they meet the so-called performance criteria, or even it's, or whether it's rely on the future good and service once supplied after the construction, the assets has been placed in use. I'm struggling in the reality, because this is the way to regulate activities. Even maybe the agreement say that, but in practice, without you know, provide any good and service after this asset has been in use, I'm not sure the entity can receive or really have rights, has rights to receive that, you know, bonus, that incentives. If it's not, I'm not sure the full recognition criteria really met, even the construction, during the construction period, those, you know, so-called performance criteria really has been met. I'm wondering if there are other criteria that still also needed to be met before, you know, they can receive the bonus, receive the incentives.
Sorry, Tadao?
Thank you, Neil, for the paper. I do support the staff's recommendation, and I do like the idea of not being too prescriptive, considering that we definitely have a variety of different types of agreement, and then it is really better if we can stick to the principle. I understand the King Charles question, but I believe that so far where the staff has landed, it is okay. But I am assuming, and that it's in a certain way related to agenda paper 9B, that the principles described in this paper are to be applied after considering IFRIC 12. And this is an important assumption, because if I'm applying IFRIC 12, I will end up recognizing this as part of my intangible financial asset instead of a regulatory asset. Is my assumption correct that I should first consider IFRIC 12 and then apply the principles for rate-regulated activities?
Yes, that is correct. An entity would apply the requirements of IFRIC 12 before looking to apply the requirements of the standard for regulated activities and determining whether it has a regulatory asset or regulatory liability.
Okay, thank you.
I had a couple of observations to Neil. So firstly, I agree with the recommendation that you've got in paragraph 21. And one of the reasons why I like the fact that we haven't made a distinction between construction and non-construction related is I think that we could get situations where, for example, if you're going to get a performance incentive for maintaining things really well, we might quickly get questions about, you know, that involves a lot of construction. So, you know, what type of incentive is it? So I think having one approach for all incentives might be easier to apply. In relation to this apportionment idea that's in paragraph 19, I am fine with this idea of a split, and I agree that we shouldn't have a sort of a rule, if you like, for how to make the apportionment. But I wonder whether we've got enough of a principle for people to decide what to do, because, and I don't know that we need to flesh that out, but maybe it's something we should get people to comment on if we put this in the document for feedback. Because, for example, should I base it on how difficult it is to do one or the other? You know, is the amount of the compensation that the conditions attach to, how much work I need to do to get it? I mean, what's our idea that we're asking people to think about to work out what the appropriate apportionment is? Because otherwise, while it, we might just end up with people doing completely different things to work out what they think the appropriate apportionment is. And also, I wonder whether there might be a place to simplify it by having a sort of concept of, you know, if it relates substantially to one thing or the other, that it all tips one way rather than being too nitty gritty with the calculation. And so I think having at least enough of those thoughts in the document for people to respond to might be helpful rather than just leaving it completely at the judgment for people to decide how they think would be best to do an apportionment, would be my suggestion. Mary, and then Gary.
Mary? You're on mute.
Sorry about that. I think more drafting points, but let me start with the point Sue was just making about paragraph 19 and the apportionment. I also wanted to flag that we may have to ask the staff to think about the drafting around apportionment, because as with Sue, I am not asking to start writing very explicit rules of if this, then that. But I think a very basic scenario that we should contemplate is what if a construction incentive is subject to the asset being put in use or subject to the passive.
Mary, we cannot hear you. I suggest we go to the next one and you come back later.
It was Gary. Gary?
Gary.
Hi, good morning. Neil, I like the general direction of your paper here and sort of agree with it, but building on where Sue was and I think where Mary was going, it does read a bit confusing, and let me explain why. So in paragraph 19, we're talking about alignment, or apportionment, I should say. Mm-hmm. Then you go up to paragraph 16, you say it's aligned with non-construction incentives. I agree with where we're going. It doesn't hold together all that well for me, and I think it needs to be worked a little bit more. Is there any, I'm just starting to wonder how important, we should give guidance, but how important in the realm of things is this? And you start wondering, is the cost-benefit test get in there, that this is a very interesting point that should be addressed, but is it that big enough in the realm of things that we need to get this precise? Do you have any sense of that?
Thanks, Gary. We do think it's important to put out specific guidance around incentives. construction and non-construction, just the kind of shift we've seen in the forms of regulation out there are a general shift towards incentive-based regulation and away from cost recovery type regulation. So I think it is important that we say something, and we do have explicit guidance, particularly if this is making up a substantial portion of an entity's profit or potential profit for a period. And if it is a substantial portion or a material portion of the top line, then I think it is important to have guidance as to how this makes it into total allowed compensation and how the model is then applied. The apportionment point is really just saying, look, we include it in total allowed compensation when the criteria are monitored and evaluated. And because that is exactly the same principle for either construction or non-construction related incentives, if you have an incentive that is notionally construction, but that you need to continue to do something once that asset is placed into operation, then there is some monitoring and evaluation that's taking place during the operation period. And so that shouldn't be disregarded entirely. And you should look to recognize the total allowed compensation, if you will, over the entire period that incentive is being earned. That is the period that the criteria are being monitored and evaluated, and there may be a split between the kind of construction and non-construction, the subsequent operation of the asset. And so just to consider that, but I think Sue made some good points there, and this could be an area where we look to have some simplifications or some guidance or some examples, or to ask whether further guidance is required in the questions that accompany the exposure draft.
So my takeaway on that, Neil, is this is more prevalent than we would have thought. In any event, it's growing in prevalence. So I completely agree with giving guidance on it. It just came across as we trying to get too precise between apportionment or not. My thought was there's just incentives, but I think and we just treat them all the same way. But I accept your point why apportionment, at least in some instances, could be important than I thought, and we go with it. I think it's still hard to read and follow, because the minute you start saying apportionment implies different answers is how I'm thinking of it. And I think just to be very careful in drafting of how you point the point. Because apportionment is a split, right? And therefore, you split to get different outcomes. And that's just not totally clear in here. But I'm okay in the basic principle you're going, but it's not clear how it's written. We'll deal with it in drafting.
Okay. Thanks, Gary.
Any other comments?
Mary, Mary wasn't finished, but I think we've lost her still.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's see if she returns. Rika.
Okay. Rika. Thank you. Oh, yes, thank you. I was on mute, so. I think I support the direction the staff proposed on this paper, especially, but I just wondering if we are discussing and considering about how to account for the performance incentive, the things like uncertainty around the recognition or the estimate of amount should be also taken into the consideration in the actual accounting treatment in practice. So I just wondering whether the staff had a plan to include how that kind of the interaction will be included in the consultation document in terms of this proposal.
Yeah, thanks, Rika. That was a matter that we brought before the board in 2019 in July, just around the fact that it may be necessary to make an estimate of whether the entity is going to become entitled to the bonus and potentially the amount of the bonus in working out how much total compensation it may become entitled to. And this is something that we propose including in the application guidance. But we do feel it's largely covered by the model's existing requirements around estimating future cash flows, applying either the most likely method or the expected value method.
Thank you. Okay. That will help the further consultation.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Has Mary returned?
And audio only, Hans.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Hans. One point I was going to pick up was back to comments Sue was making in paragraph 19 about attribution and saying it seemed it's not any objection to the notion thinking in kind of IFRS 15 terms of saying identify if there's one or multiple performance obligations. But I think in the drafting of this, without getting very prescriptive and very if this then that kind of rule, you need to think about a scenario in which it says the incentive is for construction activities, but it's subject to, say, completion of the asset or putting it into service or some kind of very generic conditionality. And whether or not that kind of thing should be considered a condition that requires separation of the incentives. That's one point. I think it's something that sits on the border of drafting and decision. The second point, and this is the drafting, and it also applies to the expression of the July decision, July 19 decision, back in paragraph 12. The goods and services supplied in the period in which the performance criteria are monitored and evaluated. I agree with this sentiment, but I'd like to ask you to think about whether the phrase in which the performance criteria are monitored and evaluated is the most effective capture of our intention, because I could see scenarios in which people got into debates about whether they were doing enough activity to monitor and evaluate it. You know, the entity that's providing the regulated services being challenged about whether their activities sufficiently cross the hurdle for monitored and evaluated. And I think what we're trying to get is more the period in which the performance criteria relate. So that is just a comment to please think about that drafting in terms of how you express the hurdle that you're identifying. That's it for me, Hans.
Okay. Changwu.
Thank you. Yeah, I agree with the step recommendation, and this is another paper that's well analyzed. But please think about the possibility of adding a kind of an example to show your logic and justification before coming to the conclusion. For example, in the case of paragraph 11, you know, we are saying the principle for target profit may result in some kind of a distorting result on their statement, the income statement. That's why we are suggesting another principle. So if you can provide an example to show this kind of different pictures of the entity's performance that give our stakeholders to understand our recommendation more easily. So that's why I suggest to think about that kind of adding one example on this part. Thank you.
Okay. Are we ready to go to the staff's recommendations in the final paper? Yes. Does the staff want to introduce?
Yeah, thank you, Hans. So I'd just like to take you through agenda paper 9D now, which is a summary and the recommendations that we've explored through papers 9A through 9C so far this morning. and just to ask for your decisions on those recommendations. So the first recommendation coming from Agenda Paper 9A is that the target profit that a regulatory agreement entitles an entity to charge customers for a specified period forms part of total allowed compensation for goods or services supplied in that period. I'd just like to ask whether the board supports the staff's recommendation on the model's general principle there.
Okay, can I see, do we need further discussion or can I call a vote? Yeah. Okay, can I see who supports the staff's recommendation?
And Mary?
No.
Okay, we have 13 in favor.
Okay. Moving on to paragraph 3 of 90, the staff also think that the principle for target profit in paragraph 2 should be applied to regulatory returns on the regulatory capital base, and therefore we recommend the regulatory returns on a regulatory capital base that a regulatory agreement entitles an entity to charge customers for a specified period form part of total allowed compensation for goods or services supplied in that period. I'd like to ask whether you support that recommendation from the staff.
Mary?
No, consistent with one.
So, that would be
so that's 13?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, moving on to the third recommendation in paragraph 4 of the paper. As explored in Agenda Paper 9B, we recommend that regulatory returns on a construction work in process base that are included in the regulated rates during the construction period form part of total allowed compensation only during the operating periods of the asset. That is, when goods or services are being supplied with the asset to which those regulatory returns relate.
Can I see who supports the staff's recommendation? Mary?
Yes.
That's all.
14.
Then the final recommendation.
And finally, for performance incentives from Agenda Paper 9C, the staff recommend that performance incentives, whether construction-related or non-construction-related, form part of total allowed compensation for goods or services supplied in the period when the relevant performance criteria are monitored and evaluated.
With some discussion of what the allocation ideas are?
On board the suggestions around allocation and the specific drafting of monitored and evaluated.
Okay. So, Mary?
Yes.
Okay. Jin Chow, Francoise, is that a no?
Jin Chow?
Okay.
No, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so that's okay. All right, so that's 12.
All right, that brings us to the end of this discussion. Thank you very much. Let's finally turn to management commentary. I think I see Julia already sitting there. Yes.
Hello, everyone. Can you hear me well?
Yes. Yes.
Perfect. So we're just giving a minute for the team to dial in while the rate regulated team disconnects.
I see Mary Claire has dialed in, but we don't see her video stream.
Mary Claire, are
Mary
you
Claire,
on?
Are you there? I think we just lost her. She'll come back.
I'll just grab a coffee. I'm back.
Got to be quick.
Mary Claire, I can see that you've logged on, but we can't see your video. Uh, Joan as well. I can see you've logged on, but I don't see your video.
Marie-Claire, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, perfect. But I think that's all we need.
You still can't see me.
No,
still can't see you now. That's strange. Okay. The camera should be on, but
okay, that's fine. As long as we can hear you and you can hear us, that's fine. So I suggest we proceed in that case. So I will start with a very quick introduction. In 2019,
actually, Julia, do you want to just give it maybe a few more minutes?
Of course.
And while we're waiting, Matt and Joan, can you just test your mics real quick? I can hear either of you.
This is Joan.
Joan, you're good.
Thank you.
Yep.
I can see Elena.
Yeah, Matt, can you try again? Yeah. Matt, I think you're on mute.
Can you hear me? It's Joan.
Yes.
Hey, Matt, I see your lips moving, but I can't hear anything. No, we'll have Simon work on that. And Yelena, let's test you as well. Can you say a few things?
Good morning, everyone.
Can you hear good?
Yep. Brilliant, thank you.
Mary, can you mute your phone? I think you're rattling.
Okay, let me try again.
Okay, this is Matt, just hoping you can hear me now.
Perfect. Yep, thank you.
Okay, I think we're good to go, Hans.